Product Stacks is brought to you by Storyblok, one of the world's fastest growing headless CMSs. A headless CMS like Storyblok separates the back end from the front end. By moving to an API-based CMS like Storyblok, you can publish your content to any front end, whether that's your marketing website or directly inside your product. Developers love Storyblok because they can use it with any front end framework they prefer and create components that can be reused anywhere as content blocks, cutting development time in half. Content teams are excited about the discussions feature built directly into Storyblok's visual editor. No more Slack or email threads to discuss content changes. Join 86,000 developers plus companies like Harvard Business School, Adidas, Netflix, Oatly, and Pizza Hut who all use Storyblok by trying a free demo at storyblok.com/departmentofproduct. Go to storyblok.com/departmentofproduct. That's Storyblok with a K at the end, /departmentofproduct. So joining us today is Christine Kowalski from Shopify, and we're going to talk through in this series what tools product managers like Christine are using in their day-to-day product roles so that you can get inspired in your day-to-day role as well. So Christine, thanks very much for taking some time out of your busy day today to chat to us. Should we kick off with just a bit of an introduction as to you know, who you are and what you work on and a bit of background?
Of course. Well, as Richard always said, I'm Christine. I'm currently located in the north of Spain. I'm a senior product manager in Shopify. I've been here for about a year and 10 months now. I've been in the shipping team all this time, okay. But owned two different or led product in two different areas. One being delivery promise, so everything around delivery expectations. And most recently, I've changed my scope into what we call shipping rating systems. So everything about shipping rates, dynamic rates that are surfaced in checkout, the experience around that, like which rates are surfaced, how fast they are surfaced. So very performance related, and the delivery settings experience. So the merchant side of things and how they set things up. Before that, I worked at Amazon for 5 years, both in Seattle most recently, and before that in Luxembourg. In terms of products that I build, I think the two that people are familiar with is one, if any one of the listeners has ever bought at Amazon and has bought a product that falls in more like a technical space, and has had trouble with it, there are two options routes that customers could choose. Is one, they could return the product if it was in fact defective, or they could actually go through a support experience. And there's a support experience that is a chat experience, a call experience, and there are also self-service workflows. I was involved in all of those products, but specifically self-service support. And the workflows and the knowledge base that powers those workflows, I built that at my time at Amazon.
Okay. And that's for all returns, is it?
Well, yeah, it's basically for any product. If you go in the returns flow, not every product needs a support flow. If you buy a t-shirt, most likely you won't need it. But for example, coffee machine, very likely you will find my product there.
Very nice.
As a support flow. And most recently in Shopify, I launched Shop Promise. I don't know if people are familiar with it. It was quite big in the news, but maybe not. It is, from an experience point of view, it is the ability for merchants to surface delivery expectations, so delivery dates on the product page. But the feature, so the pure product feature itself, is linked to a program experience that is really more a promise around this merchant delivering the product highly reliable and very fast. And right now it is linked to using SFN as a fulfillment service. So merchants that use SFN, our fulfillment network, to basically deliver their products to customers will be able to advertise this highly reliable and fast experience on their product page. So my team basically built the platform to capture delivery dates, but then also the entire solution to surface that on product pages and the user experience around that, and product pages and checkout actually. So being able to surface promises. Yeah, those two are probably the biggest one most recently.
And you mentioned SSN. Is that like Shopify's?
SFN, Shopify Fulfillment Network.
Ah, okay. So does Shopify now own the kind of the full stack in terms of logistics, or are they still using third party? How does it work?
Both, but yeah, we have basically our own warehouse solution where merchants can stock their products and
Ah,
then
okay.
we take care of it.
Oh, brilliant. Awesome. Yeah, I used to work in fulfillment as well, actually, when I was at eBay,
Oh,
and it's a I had no
it's a different world, huh?
yeah it's I had no experience whatsoever before I joined. I was like, okay, well, it can't be that difficult. But then you get into the details, you're like, wow, this is such a deep, deep world, like logistics and shipping. It's like, oh my God, like there's so much to it. There's so much depth there. And it is
Yeah,
fascinating when you get into, like you mentioned, like shipping rates, people just take that for granted. You go onto an e-commerce website, you see the price of shipping. People don't realize how much legwork goes into the back end in coming up with those shipping rates. And then, it's, yeah, tracking is a massive world, as you know all this. So I'm of course, but I'm just, for listeners, it's a
no, of
huge,
course.
it's a huge world, a huge space.
Yeah, and I think that the interesting part of it, like, of course, there's the whole experience that you're focused on, like what is a streamlined experience, what do customers want? But I feel the really nitty-gritty, what people don't immediately think about is we're talking about massive scale here.
Yep.
Like whatever you build needs to work for a Shopify 2 million merchants. And then thinking even about like the amount of customers those 2 million merchants support and the amount of checkouts those generate, like just the volume is I think the part that doesn't immediately come to mind because you first think just about the streamlined experience and the individual user, but whatever you do just needs to scale massively. And that's where things become really interesting.
Yeah. And from a product perspective as well, it's one of the rare roles where it's online plus offline as well, because the decisions you make for the digital product inevitably then have a knock-on effect in the physical world. And that isn't something that many domains actually have. So it's quite an, like, logistics is quite fairly unique in that respect. Yeah. So before we get into your product stacks, we thought we would take a little bit of a look at the overall process at Shopify. And I'm just gonna share my screen. And this can be either broadly speaking at Shopify globally or just locally within your personal team as well. So we've got like three different areas. The first area is roadmap and strategy. The second area is how, what is a typical product team, if such a thing exists? What does a team look like at Shopify? And then finally, what software development process are you using? And then when we come on to your product stacks, we thought we could then use this as a place to kind of almost contextualize some of the products that you use on a day-to-day basis. So maybe if we just start with the process of road mapping and strategy, and if you could talk a little bit to us about, how do you do this at Shopify?
I think so overall. Speaking for Shopify overall, I think the process that we generally use is the GSD process. It's literally getting shit done. That's what it's called.
Yeah,
And that
okay.
process has
Fair
various
enough.
stages. It all starts with a mission. So we have the company mission that you also pointed out here to make commerce better for everyone. And we also have on a company level certain product principles that really help us to inform what we build and how we build it. I can share some examples. I don't know them all by heart. I hope that's fine.
Yeah, no worries, no worries.
Build what most merchants need most of the time. Then, that's how we we have a in Shopify. We obviously have a we have a core product, and then it's also known by now that we expand it. So we work at principle level, and that's on an overall mission level. But
Yeah.
then if you go one step deeper on an individual, let's say team level, and I'm actually going through this process right now, like just joined a new team. We decided, okay, we need to change direction. The roadmap that we had until now doesn't work anymore. We really start with these very same question. Okay, in order to make commerce better for everyone, what is our lower level mission, vision that we want to accomplish? For example, in rating systems, we want to make sure that we have a super streamlined checkout experience that provides highly converting shipping rates. So we create the best possible buyer experience because it's streamlined. They get great shipping options. we offer the best possible merchant experience, because what our merchants want is make sales, right? They want to create a great buyer experience to grow their business. By providing those experience, we do that. And we also need to think of our partners and how we help them to create this experience, because we want to also create the best possible experience for them. Mm-hmm. And so we create a vision on a lower level. We define the principles according to which we work at a lower level. We define success metrics at a lower level. And then based on that, we identify the individual initiatives that feed back to that. And until recently, if you identify you have an initiative in your roadmap that actually doesn't tie back to one of your KPIs, and with that back to your vision, you probably should not prioritize that in your roadmap. Mm-hmm. We're doing it.
I mean, that's brilliant to hear that everything is so aligned to your overall mission. Often, like what we see is like there's often like a disconnect between the vision and the mission of the company and actually what people are working on day to day. It can sometimes get lost in the storm. So the fact that you're doing that, like, you know, is must be really rewarding to know that every decision that you make on a strategic level is so aligned to the overall vision and mission of the company.
I think it's also like fair to acknowledge that you need to do cleanup once in a while, right? You get stuck into day to day, and then you need to take a step back, and you're like, have to reflect on certain initiatives and ask yourself, are they still the right thing? Like, is that still the right direction?
Yeah.
And it happens often enough that you kill basically a project. Like, that's just, it's painful for everybody involved, but from an overall perspective, it's the right decision.
Yeah.
That's what we as product managers actually get paid for taking that pain and taking that hit of saying, okay, engineering, you invested weeks into this, but unfortunately I have to tell you this is no longer, or this is just not aligned. This is not the highest priority. Let's pause it.
Yeah. And you also mentioned as well that, you know, one of the main things you try to do is to prioritize what's important for customers as well. And I just wondered whether you have any particular frameworks that you use to kind of figure out what's most important to a user. I know there's things like top tasks that some teams will use. Or, you know, have you got any frameworks that you use at Shopify which allows you to decide, you know, what are the most important things for our customers to get done using their product?
I think that's a great point. So one is, like, from a framework perspective, I think there's, what is it called, RASI, like, that we consider. What is the impact? How feasible is this? What is the effort? I don't actually use the specific framework, more conceptually.
Yeah.
But just to abstract a little bit from this, because we talk about it later when we talk about product sex, right? I don't use a specific tool. The decision is based on data. What is the, like, we do this initiative for a certain KPI, for example. Let's say I want to reduce latency in checkout. This initiative can bring down my latency by 200 milliseconds versus another one that is 100 milliseconds. So data is one input. I'm going to jump a little bit forward because we're going to talk about this again, but data should not be the only, like, we're not a data-driven company at Shopify. Yeah. We're a data-informed company. Yeah. So we don't blindly run about data. So there is also qualitative aspects that need to be considered. That could be through research. That could be also through having an opinion. And that's maybe my third aspect if we think about a framework. Principles are used at every stage in Shopify to help us make the right decisions. And good principles actually bring intention. Very often, let's say, making quickly up an example, the best interest of the merchant might not always be aligned with the best interest of the partner, for example. And we need to decide, we need principles that help us in a given this moment to decide who do we prioritize. Mm-hmm. Are we merchant obsessed first? And if we're merchant obsessed, what are the gatekeepers? What are the guardrails we put in place to protect our partners? So for example, we could say that, okay, we optimize for merchants first. So we're doing the right thing that they can grow their business best. We don't create maybe the best possible partner experience, but we put guardrails in place so we at least not harm their experience. And we're not making it worse than it currently is. We're just not making it better. So I feel principles is another good way to help you make those trade-offs and decide which direction to go.
Yeah, I think the subtle difference between being data informed and data led isn't something that every product team truly, you know, understands. And as you say, it, like, principles can really help. And having an opinion as well, as you said, is something that I think some PMs are actually quite frightened to say, well, the reason we've chosen to do this is because, you know, I have a strong feeling that this is the right thing to do. And sometimes, you know, with experience, you do develop a sixth sense as to what is the right thing to do. And, you know, you may be wrong, but over time, your ability to place stronger bets actually gets better. And I think I was reading something the other day. I think it was one of the Stripe product principles, which was like, we expect PMs to almost like have taste. So have a sense of what will work for the customer rather than just blindly saying, oh, here's a number that says the conversion rate has gone up because we changed the font to blue. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's the right thing to do.
Agreed. And I think related to that point, I think we're also taught a lot that we need to test our opinions a lot. And once you learn how expensive testing, and by testing I mean experimentation, is,
yeah,
like in terms from effort, like resource involved, data engineering, everybody kind of comes in, I feel you become also more selective and trust your guts more. Like, am I really doubting that this increases conversion? No, actually, that's like, it's such a no-brainer. If I want to know how much, I will need to do an A/B test. But if it's just to say, does this increase conversion, like, I'm good enough without an experiment. I think that's also something we're not trained to trust ourselves that much, but it's actually a good skill to develop over time.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so what does a team look like at Shopify?
So in Shopify, we work in a multi-factor kind of setup. So every team has, I mean, unless the resource is missing. So I'm talking about an ideal state here. We have a product manager, we have a UX representative, depending on the team size, with directs, one or more directs to report into. We have an engineering manager with an engineering squad or more under, and then we have a data representative, potential directs as well. That's what we call the kind of product team multi-factor. Those teams are involved in early stages of the product development. Very different experience for me, for example, to how I worked in Amazon. Like in Amazon, I shared an engineering team across multiple other product managers. My team was actually a team of product managers. Right now at Shopify, my team is my multi-factor. Those are the people I talk to every day. I have daily stand-ups. I have weekly meetings with.
Yeah.
The product manager interaction is actually much less than I used to have. So that's kind of the product team structure. And then we have a go-to-market. Sorry,
just a quick question. On how many people would be part of a team like this?
Great question. Really depends. So my previous team, I had one UX manager with two product designers, one content designer. So a UX team of four. Then an engineering team of, at the end, I think it was 15, a data team of four, and myself.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's quite a big team then.
It is, but it got even bigger now with my new team, actually. So now I have one PM, but I have two engineering managers, and each of the engineering manager has a squad of like 11 engineers. And
right. Wow. Okay. They're big teams.
They're big teams, but
how do you find that? Because in my experience, like sometimes, depending on the cast of characters involved, but sometimes the bigger the engineering team, it can, like, sometimes managers will say, okay, well, we need to increase velocity, therefore we should add X number of engineers into the mix. And inevitably that doesn't, you know, it's not an equation. So to me that seems like quite a large number of, like, 11 engineers in one team seems quite big, but how do you find that works?
I think one thing I want to put ahead of that is we have kind of this saying, and I like at Shopify, everybody in Shopify works on product.
Right.
So I think that's also something to keep in mind, because yes, there is the product manager, and like a lot of the strategic decisions, they need to be made by, like, at least led by the product manager with close collaboration with all the other crafts. But it's also important to acknowledge, like, since everybody works on product, there are many, many day-to-day decisions that the team should feel empowered to take.
Yeah. Okay.
And we complement also the role of the product manager with something that we call champion. And the project champion is almost like a little bit like the project manager. So it complements.
Right. Okay.
I feel it's something that happens very often that the product manager is actually mistaken to being a project manager, although being two very different things. So that muscle that very often is asked from the product manager is kind of distributed across other crafts because everybody can champion a project, and a project champion is not responsible for making every decision, but ensuring that every decision is made. So that person keeps the team on track and kind of balances a little bit the load there. So I think that's great. I think the downside right now of the size of the team is you lose, and also fair to say, it depends on how the product manager wants to work, right? But you lose a little bit touch to the individual contributors on the team. You work a lot more through the managers than with the individual people doing the job. Because, I mean, if you have 20 individual contributors, like having a one-on-one sessions with everyone is not possible. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. In fact, it does. Like you have, depending on what the project is, what the person's working on, you have pair program sessions, you have like you brainstorm assumption slams, etc. But it depends. It depends also on the person and like what they're working on. It's not the default, I'd say.
And your role as a senior product manager, how does that fit into this?
So I'm basically the purple, sorry, looking this way because that's where I have the real, I'm the connecting point in the middle, I'd say.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. Really, that's really interesting. I mean, companies like Facebook will, you mentioned, you know, the role of project management, and like companies, I think like Facebook will sometimes have like the tech leads doing a lot of the project management side of things as well. And then obviously some companies will split the role of product owner and product manager. So it sounds like the product, almost like the product owner role is distributed to whoever the champion is in this team, which is quite an interesting way of doing it. And I like, you know, I like the way that you know, mentioned about like everyone working in product, essentially. I think we're seeing more and more of that now. There isn't really just like the product team. It's more like, okay, well, everyone is building the product. So you've got product designers, product engineers, product managers, and it's nice to see everyone adopting that product-centric mindset, isn't it? So yeah, and then the final part of this before we delve into your product stack was the like kind of like day-to-day, like the execution of software development. So what do you at Shopify, what is the process that you follow for actually building the software?
I don't think I can speak for Shopify because I feel what is great is every team should find the way that works for them. In my previous team, we worked in actually in the new team as well. We work in almost weekly sprints.
Okay.
So every week, the project team, it's on a project, the squad, the team members working on one project together, come together, where we add what needs to happen until the end of the year, which tasks are prioritized. We use GitHub. So we go through the GitHub board and basically see where we're at. The product manager doesn't need to be involved there a lot. What is important that we're aligned between whoever runs those sprint sessions and the product manager is what are our key milestones? So let's say if we have often products are released in multiple versions, right? You have like your V1, your V2, and your V3.
Yeah.
What are the must-haves for V1 and align on that? And so, and what are our timelines that we're targeting? So whoever runs that knows, okay, if we're off track, we need to flag that early because it has downstream implications on release timelines, etc.
And is this process something that you have almost experimented your way to, or you know, are there other processes that you've adopted and haven't quite worked out well for you? Or, you know, how did you land up with this process specifically?
I think that specific in the team was something that almost came through the tech lead in that moment. I worked through other processes. Like in other teams, it's really like the product manager gives, or in other companies as well. Like I gave these are my business requirements. This is what needs to be built. This is the complementing UX. And this is when we release. And then the team was very much like running on their own organizing their work through the Dev Manager alone. That was very like almost shielded to me. Yeah. And then it was more weekly check-ins. Is there anything off track? Is there a risk? Is there something? Are there open questions? We identified blockers and we need to rethink UX. It was more using that as an escalation channel without there necessarily being an escalation. It's more like, hey, let's get together and see where we are. But I wasn't that involved in the planning.
Okay. And do you prefer this setup? What are the ups and downsides, would you say, of this? Have you had any?
I think heavy involvement in planning, the downside is really bandwidth, depending on how many projects you have running in parallel and how many of those discussions you're involved, because it's like they're just so many days, it's so many hours in a day. But I do like the great part is of being part of these discussions is being able to detect things early, being involved in discussions early, and not just like when the team also feels, ooh, now we're at risk, but be like more being able to be more proactive about it. And being able also understand the other craft and how they work better. I think that's a great part. Like, to be fair, that's something that I love about the setup in Shopify is I've learned so much about how my other craft's counterpart work. And I actually like adopted some of their working, like some of their tools, and we'll talk about them in a bit. Like one of them is like, I literally stole it from UX because I thought like, I love this. I need to use this. And if you don't have this exposure, be it through planning sessions, being part of pairing sessions or all these kind of workshops, like it's much harder to get. So yeah, I think that's one of the things.
Perfect. Yeah. So with that then, shall we delve into your product stack? So we're going to look at three different products. Should we start with the first product that you've chosen?
Yeah. So the first tool you mentioned, right?
First tool, yeah. First tool.
Awesome. Cool. Sorry, yeah. Yes. So product stack. Like just to reiterate, like what I've chosen is not related to any specific tool. Mm-hmm. You could use anything, pen and paper, anything to do this. And okay. The reason why I ended up deciding or why I use these in my day, that's how I work as a product manager. And one of the key reasons is I really like to be independent and autonomous. And I know that companies have opinions about what tools they support and what you can use, what you can't use. And I don't want to make myself dependent on any of these. And then I change job, I change company, or even my company decides, oh, we have only 5 users of this. It really doesn't make sense to pay the license. Like that can happen, right? And then I can't use it anymore. So I've chosen tools in that direction. My very first tool is doc writing. To be fair, I had no idea that not every product manager uses doc writing as extensively as I'm used to. So thought it'd be maybe good to share. I think it's pretty known that Amazon is a very doc writing heavy company. Shopify is as well different, but also very writing heavy. I brought examples from both companies to just, perfect. They're fake. Yeah. But they're just to give you an idea to like different types of docs.
I feel just on doc writing, it's quite fascinating, I think, because over the last maybe like 12, 15 years since I've been working in product, the trend has, initially when I started out, doc writing was like kind of very, it was an essential part of product management. And then I'd say probably maybe 5 years ago, or maybe like 5 years in, it kind of lost its cool factor. Like my first roles, I was working with a guy from Microsoft, and I was wowed by his documents, and like they were so detailed, so like they were basically the requirements of absolutely every interaction. It was like a product requirements document. And then over the years, as we adopted more kind of agile lean methodologies, documentation was seen as like almost like a bit old fashioned because of the corporate association with those massive companies. But over the last, I'd say the last 3 or 4 years, documents have become cool again and writing is cool again. And as you worked at Amazon, so they have the culture of writing the press releases. And I think part of it depends how you use documents. Like you can using a document to say, when a user clicks their mouse, this should happen, is very different to saying, well, here are the principles we follow. Here are some of the strategic decisions. Here's the scope of what V1 should achieve. You know, I feel like documentation has evolved.
Yeah, it definitely differs. And I also think, I mean, there is a limit. You know, if if doc writing comes to a point that you have version 20 and you discuss if a word is crisp enough, like, yeah, no, it's like, I know why it happens and I've seen it happen, but not a huge fan of that. But personally, like every product manager has this first moment, this I have this great idea and you're just on fire for the idea. And doc writing helps me to think through, to really challenge myself, make sure I consider the problem that I'm trying to solve from various angles. As I work through the doc, I identify aspects, and in the first moment you don't consider nuances. And yeah, I'm thinking, I also feel like it puts me in a place that I train myself about how am I gonna communicate this to? Because once you're able to communicate that properly and lay it out to yourself, you can do that much better to leadership. Like, what is the problem? Why is it important? What is the solution? What are the limitations of the solution? What is the opportunity for us? What is the customer experience going to look like? There's so many angles to this. And I feel like unless you, or personally, like, I need this on a paper and I need to challenge myself to go through this process of writing it all out to make sure I didn't miss anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are different ways you mentioned on how to do that. And I'll just like, brought the two that I'm familiar with now. This is the one. Okay, cool. So, like, one example I brought is the Amazon press release. Done for Shopify.
Yes.
I don't know if people are familiar with, but Amazon follows kind of the working backwards mechanism. So they start with the customer.
And mm-hmm.
Problem and work backwards from there. And the most typical doc is what they call the PR FAQ. What I brought is a PR without an FAQ. So because the FAQ takes a long time, but the whole process takes a long time, but I wanted to bring an example. It's really
interesting.
You start from, imagine the product that you wanted to build is live, and you have to write a short press release for your local newspaper. What is the experience now? And that short press release addresses the question, like, who is the customer? What is the customer's problem or the opportunity? What is the biggest benefit of the solution that you just launched for the customer? How do you know what the customer wants? Maybe what is very common is that you introduce here and there a quote of a customer. Oh, until recently I had this problem, but now thanks to this great solution, I finally can do ABC.
Yeah.
And
would they be real? They would obviously be fake, would they? Or would they be like, would that be based on some research or something like that? Or would it just be?
It could absolutely be that it could be a result of a merchant telling you exactly that.
So let's say you've written this and you think, you know, it does a good job of describing this from a customer's perspective. What would be the next step then? Would you then share it with stakeholders and have almost like a discussion between the stakeholders and figure out what's missing?
Exactly. You would, in Amazon, I would primarily share it with my product management team. Then you might have identified certain stakeholders that have dependency on the experience that you are building. So you would share it with them as well. And yeah, basically identify those, get feedback, get it refined, incorporate the feedback and another round, and then you go to leadership, basically have multiple rounds of feedback until it's basically decided, yes, this is a good product, we prioritize it, and it needs to go on the roadmap and be staffed, which is if you share an engineering team across other product managers and you do not have your dedicated engineering team, like it's now the case for me in Shopify, like that might be much harder. In my team, that was the case. We had three product managers and one engineering team. So we had basically together need to find, okay, which product lands where, which has the highest impact based on what we're trying to achieve as an overall team.
Perfect.
So, but yeah, it's a lot of a very feedback heavy and iterative approach. It's not you write one product and you're done.
Yeah, fair enough.
Cool. The other thing, we talked earlier about kind of when we built the vision and mission that we also incorporate like product, we put principles in place and we have a clear structure of what we follow in terms of questions that we ask ourselves in the roadmap. And when in Shopify, when we define, kick off a new project and we follow that same workstream from the mission to the GSD, so get shit done process, the GSD process has multiple steps. And the first step is making a proposal. And that's very much the product manager's job. Like, what are we going to do and why are we doing it? And that proposal has multiple components. And it's a very, very fit. Like, everybody can do their whatever they want, of course. But we have kind of a template we can follow. I find it very impactful and easy to make sure I address all aspects. I think this through. On the very top, like, you decide what you define, what is the problem, opportunity you're actually wanting to solve. And it's very much a bullet points thing. Like, you can leverage data, for example, like, this is secondary data. 83% of buyers expect delivery promises to be surfaced early in the buyer flow. That's kind of like, that's a problem or an opportunity if you currently don't support that. And so you describe the problem, can be really much bullet points. And then you have a second section where it's really very much about what are the outcomes you want to achieve with the solution. Mm-hmm. For example, we are able to calculate relevant delivery options on a product for each product. For example, that could be a high level outcome. Whatever you want to solve and the solution you want to build is based on assumption. Your starting assumption is buyers care about seeing delivery dates on the product page. Mm-hmm. But your second assumption is merchants actually want to surface them.
Yeah.
Like, you building this product is based on a serious assumption. Some of those assumptions might actually count as facts, and some might be super wild. The wilder, actually, the better. Like, whatever you... Sorry.
How do you come up with assumptions? I often find that, like, there's obviously the basic level assumptions, which really, really come naturally to me. But then sometimes I'm thinking, hey, I can't... I'm definitely assuming certain things, but I can't figure out what I'm assuming, if that makes sense. So is there a process you go through to kind of think, okay, what are the other assumptions that we've got that underpin this idea?
I think one way to do this, and it's actually one of the tools that I'm going to show later, is through visualization. Or is this even a problem? That could be a general question. Like, what assumptions do you make that this is a problem? And the one I mentioned earlier, merchants want to surf it. Like, the fact that delivery options, visualization is a tool to use it, but you actually need other people and do an assumption slam.
Yeah.
And the real question you put out there is, what needs to be true in order for whatever you're building to actually make sense, to actually solve the problem? Or the fact that your team should build a solution to surface delivery promise on product pages is based on the assumption that buyers even care about it. Otherwise it makes literally no sense. So then it's not a problem. So kind of one is around, is this actually a problem? What needs to be true for this to be a real problem? And then, is your solution actually, the way you're thinking about the solution, not the detailed one, actually the right direction? And what needs to be true for that to be the case? So assumptions. And then the third part we talked about is principle, which very much help us define how we're going to build the product or trade-offs that we're willing to make. So for example, like, one is, there's external research that supports the fact that customers, the closer they come to checkout, the more specific they expect their information to be. So we use this information and form a principle around and say, our solution needs to be more and more specific in the information displayed with regard to delivery, the closer the customer comes to checkout. So right. We're fine if the date on the product page is not as specific as the date in checkout, because that is in line with what customers expect.
That's really nice. Yeah.
Then risks and dependencies, super important. And they always, like, what other teams are you dependent on? What are risks that did you foresee? Defining what is out of scope, it's also very important. Like, being very clear early on, what am I not going to solve for? Yeah. If I'm building something for the product page, I'm not going to build something for the cart. Those are two different pages.
People, yeah, I feel like people really struggle with that one, like just being very, very clear about what's not in scope as well, as I'm sure you are, you know, obviously. But I often found it's one of those areas that people really struggle with, is like committing to not doing something.
Yeah, and I think we've also been trained to include in our way of thinking what the goal is, but not so much what the not goal is.
Yeah,
and definitely. I think that's a really important part as well. How we measure success. I think that's really, like, while being a data-informed company, like, making sure you think early on of what metrics are you moving the needle back on, and tying that back to the mission, your division, your team has. Because if they are misaligned, then there's a risk that mid-process, someone from leadership is going to come around and say, why do you do this? This has nothing to do with what your team wants to do. So I think that's an important part to keep that always in mind. And that's basically it.
That's brilliant. Really, I think people will find this really useful as a point of reference as well, something like this. Would you use Google Docs for this, or do you use things like Notion?
So Google Docs and previously, honestly, Word.
Yeah.
Nothing fancy at all.
Yeah, like, simple.
Super simple, exactly.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Should we move on to your second area?
Yeah. I won't share screen, but I just recommend every product manager to learn SQL and be independent with data and be able to understand data.
Yeah.
And it's empowering. It gives you such a powerful skills. It helps you in your conversations. Yeah, I think I've been able to just make good decisions faster by being able to pull my own data.
Yeah.
I think, again, important is, like, there is a pitfall if you're using a lot of data to become data-driven rather than data-informed. So it's always important to kind of keep that in checks and balances and not blindly run after the numbers. And it's also, but it's really just important to also consider, like, opinions alone or opinion-based approach alone won't get you very far if, for example, your opinion is misaligned with leadership's opinion. Because if everything you argue is only based on opinion and there's misalignment, leadership will never go your direction. But yeah. If you have data to back up your opinion, or if you build your opinion based on data, you have a lot stronger case to make. So I think that's my second tool. Absolutely recommend it. There's so many great tutorials out there. I'm not talking about trying to become a data scientist. Like, there are simple things that just make everybody's life so much easier.
So do you use any particular tools to do, so you run all your own SQL queries, do you? Or
and yeah. Well, I mean, I have a data scientist, so everything that gets super complex, and there's a return on investment, right? There's things where if I do it myself, it's faster, but if it gets too complex, then I just, like, better I let the real champions do their job.
I remember
when
I first got into product, I had no SQL skills whatsoever, and there was an assumption at the company I was at that everyone just knew SQL. And I remember just, like, frantically going on to, I think it was like W3 Schools or something, one of those websites where you just have to, like, learn the basics. And it can be quite intimidating, you know, because you as PMs, you're never quite sure how much technical knowledge you're meant to have. And, like, the business sees you as an extension of the tech team, and then the engineering team see you as an extension of the business, and you're kind of, like, sandwiched between the two. And with things like SQL, I was never really sure whether it was, like, my domain, but I forced myself to learn some. And as you said, you know, it's something that once you have the skill, as long as the queries you do are relatively straightforward, it can massively speed up your time to getting the data that you need, rather than, like, in some companies, you have to, like, put in a data request to a separate team, and then they'll prioritize that request, and, you know, weeks can go by.
Exactly. It slows you down. So I think that it's really powerful. But I did exactly what you did. When I joined my first internship, it was literally, I worked on a data, like, I was worked on a data product.
Right.
And I had no clue of SQL. And now I'm just so, like, I'm a huge fan. It's my number one tool. Like, every more junior product manager I've ever mentored, and then I was like, what would you do? Like, this. 100%. put the time. It's so exciting. And it doesn't need to be, like I said, like, it doesn't need to be super complex stuff, right? I'm not talking about being able to write sequels of 100 lines. No, I mean, sometimes five lines of SQL allows you to make a very strong point. And it's so great and so such an empowering also feeling, because I find it hard as a product manager, since we don't create, right? Like, we're not developers, so we don't be like, oh, I built this tool. We can say, and I said earlier, yeah, my team built this tool, but actually I had, like, what did I do in the building? Like, not really involved. So being able to run your queries and see the output of your own stuff is actually something that is quite rewarding once in a while.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah, you got like a sense of ownership. It's like something, you know, you can show off to the engineers and say, look, I can do stuff. Like, I am contributing. Here's my SQL report.
Yeah, I'm not only writing docs, huh? I'm giving feedback. I'm also producing here number.
So going back to tools for SQL, is there a particular one that you like, or what do you normally use?
Well, I mean right now in Shopify we use Mode, and then Amazon changed while I was there. I feel like we used an Oracle product when I started, and we used maybe an Amazon product when I ended. Like, there are a lot of Amazon owned tools, but I have to be honest, I don't recall. But yeah, it's anything. The switches make it a little bit harder. Also, how data is organized, like getting familiar with all the tables, the relevant tables. It's not always super easy, but that's my number one recommendation to everyone who thought about, like, what helps me level up. I strongly believe this is a massive driver.
Perfect. Should we move on to your third and final product as part of your product stack?
Yeah, it's about visualization. And again, you can use everything, like pen and paper, whiteboarding, which I miss a lot in this digital by design thing. So right now, using FigJam. We used to have Miro before that. Then I used Miro. Like, those are the tools. But really, it's just about, for me, being able to draw boxes and arrows. Like, that sounds very stupid, but my mind is very visual. And if I talk through a problem and I think about, okay, so the customer comes in and then they click this, and then this should happen. I need to see this to see my pitfalls. So I use visualization a lot. Let me just do that while I'm talking. So I use a lot kind of the flow of a decision tree, and I visualize it through that. And this thing, I have to zoom in. Like, I think if I zoom out, nobody can see anything properly. So I'll do that quickly just to give a full view. But that's kind of like how my brain then works. And I know you can write all of that down, but for me, to make sure I don't miss a piece, I don't have a logical error in my thinking, visualization is key. The second part is actually related to the proposal that I showed earlier, and the structure, and about assumptions.
Yeah, I could see that. And was it called Assumption Slam?
Exactly. That's the tool I mentioned earlier that I steal tools from UX. Like, assumptions. Oh, okay. When I joined Shopify, I had no idea what an Assumption Slam is. And then my UX team actually introduced it to me and was like, you know, it's part of our proposal process that we need to define assumptions. And then the Assumption Slam, you come together as a team and come up with assumptions for your product. But the actual, what I think is really useful thing, is using a kind of like this 4x2x2 between important and unimportant assumptions, or risky or less risky, and known and unknown, because they trigger actions. There are certain assumptions that you have that are going to be facts, like something that you can easily, even if you don't have the data point ready, you know, you can pull the data point from data warehouse. Like, I made someone up, it's like, most shops use flat rates, which are either condition based or condition free. There's no ambiguity around this. I might not have the number handy, but 100% I know this. And for example, if my product is related or requires that a merchant or a shop uses a flat shipping rate, then obviously that this fact is true is very important. but it's not really, I mean, it's known. So there's nothing really for me to act on other than making sure I consider this in my future. Mm-hmm. If now tomorrow I start building something for actually dynamic rates instead of flat rates, and I ignored this fact, then I probably have built the wrong product. There are other assumptions that are very important, but they're unknown. So, for example, when surfacing delivery information on the product page, merchants care more about creating transparency than about creating add-to-cart conversion. Whether this is true or not actually defines what options you surface on the product page, or in which cases you surface delivery expectations on the product page. So it's really important for you to understand, is that true or not, or what is the truth about this assumption? But since you don't know it, that's one of the first things you need to address. And yeah, just two examples, but basically that's one of the things that I use a lot, visualization for myself, because also where you put these sticky notes on the X or Y axis helps you prioritize your work. If this is my most important but unknown assumption, I should not start working on this one. it's kind of, it helps you structure as well. So,
and I really like how this then links back to the previous document examples as well. So you can kind of supplement your docs with visual representations of the same points, just to reiterate them and help you think through them. This is really helpful.
And it's really powerful as you go into, for example, leadership reviews. And very often leadership will ask, but have you thought about A or B or C? And these exercises, when you also bring in the entire team and bring in different perspectives, they allow you to then go back and think like, yep, but we, for example, decided that this is not important because of ABC. Or, yeah, we agreed that this is important unknown, so we have research involved to take a look at this and help us answer this. So that it also helps you like really drive conversation with leadership, which I find really useful sometimes.
Yeah, I can imagine. Like this is exactly the kind of thing. And would your team members also feed into this as well?
Exactly. Like the first exercise would be everybody just put posters of assumptions they have, and yeah, then put them along these axes. And then maybe there's some we can't place, so we talk them through. Maybe there's some that are too close together, because it's also important that you don't have the same rating for all kinds of assumptions, because that doesn't allow you to prioritize. So if we get into that point, we need to move them around, but yeah.
Perfect. And why is it called a slam?
Just because the team comes together and we just go bananas on assumptions.
Yeah, fair enough. I really like it. I've never heard of that phrase either. So it's quite
neither
have
I.
I like it.
Yeah, but actually, like I said, this is not a product tool. It's literally something I stole from our UX team. But I thought it was brilliant, and I made it part of my, like, all we talked about today was actually like tools that are very, very much involved in early product development, right? It's what are we doing it? Why are we doing it? And the early thinking about what does the solution look like?
Yeah.
Different tools, same tools, but maybe different examples are then used at the second stage, where you're actually in a point of, okay, we aligned that this is what we're doing. The problem is irrelevant. The problem is important. This team should prioritize this work and go deeper into how are you going to solve it? You might still write docs. You use probably still visualization, but the specific use cases might be slightly different.
Perfect. Thank you so much for sharing all of your insights and all the different tools that you use in day-to-day work. I think we're going to, this is definitely going to christen a lot of new SQL gurus who are working in product. You know, we're going to get a lot of people like becoming SQL gods. So
you don't have to become data scientist. It's more like, I think it's important, because if you go into this exercise with the goal, I want to do all my queries by myself, it can become very frustrating very easily. That's not what it should be about. It's about getting also a feeling for data. I think it's a really important skill set.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And if people want to follow you, do you have a following on Twitter or LinkedIn or something like that? Or can people keep in touch
LinkedIn
that way? LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. So thank you very much, Christine, for sharing all of the insights into your products.
Thank you very much, Richard.